across the other end of I-70 in the city of Kansas City, Missouri, there is a brand new exhibition that's been open for a little while at the Union Station there that's going to be there through May, and it's called The Science of Rock. The Science of Rock, all about the technology and science that have made rock and roll the phenomenon that it has been for, well, now close to 60 years. Alan Cross is the director of content for that exhibition, and I've asked him to join us here today and talk a little bit about it. Hi, Alan. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining me.
No problem.
Last night, while my wife and daughter and I were having dinner, I actually listened to a vinyl album at home because I still have a collection of several thousand of them from my rock and roll DJ days. And I thought to myself, well, this is perfect. Since I'm talking to Alan tomorrow, why don't I listen to some really old technology, some old science before we get going? And at the end of the fourth song, in other words, one side of that, my daughter said, hey, what happened to the CD? And I said, what do you mean? She said, I think it stopped for some reason. I said, no. This was technology where you only got four songs at a time. Then you had to physically get up and turn it over if you wanted more music. Now, it's interesting to me that she's kind of familiar with LPs. She's kind of familiar with CDs, but she's of the digital generation. She probably spans everything that you've got in your exhibition.
Probably. Actually, maybe not, because we go back as far as wax cylinders and how music was first captured back in the late 1800s. There was a time about 100 years ago where most of these new talking machines were also recorders. So there were a number of people who not only played popular music of the day on their cylinders, but they also made their own. In fact, there's a family that was called the Wall family, and they have a museum exhibition right now in London at the London Museum. And what they did was they captured their lives on cylinders between 1902 and 1917. So it's conversations of the family, it's the kid singing songs, it's somebody playing instruments, it's somebody reciting poetry. So this has been going on an awful lot longer than most people realize.
So as that technology has changed, as the science of rock has changed through the years from the wax cylinder to even 78 RPM to 33 and 45 RPM vinyl records, then to reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes and 8-tracks and CDs and now digital downloads, that's all a delivery system. What has that done to the content, the actual rock and roll?
Well, that's a big story. You're going to the how we get music is often in changes the way we perceive it, the way we want to play it, the way we want to pay for it, which is just one part of this exhibition. We show how the ability to the change from music becoming a public thing, a communal thing, through technology became something that was enjoyed in private, that was enjoyed solitarily, and how that all changed the way music was consumed. I mean, this is a very big topic. Let me just kind of back up a little bit and tell you what's going on. We thought about this exhibit because we realized that without science and technology and electricity and mathematics and physics, rock and roll would not exist, because you need to be able to tame electricity in different ways for the music to be captured, the music to be performed, the music to be distributed, the music to be listened to. So we started looking at what sorts of science and technology went into music, and we realized that, yes, we can talk about things like vinyl and 8-tracks and reel-to-reels and all that sort of stuff, but it goes even deeper than that. What are the physical principles? What are the scientific principles? What are the things the inventions that moved rock and roll forward? For example, we can talk about the transistor, which came out in 1947, and the second ever device created using transistor technology was the transistor radio, right behind the hearing aid. And the transistor radio had a tremendous effect on the distribution of rock and roll, because up until that point, everybody had a console radio in the living room, and everybody gathered around the console radio like we gather around the TV these days. But the transistor radio was the first thing that made music portable. You could take it out of the house, take it away from the prying ears and eyes of your parents. And at this thing, which first appeared in 1954, allowed teenagers, which was this brand new construct, this new demographic group that had been identified in the years following World War II, to take their music away from the home and out to where other teenagers were. This coincided with the rise of rock, of course, in the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. And this transistor radio became this delivery mechanism for the social and economic and cultural and political and sexual revolutions that came with the messages of rock. So that's the kind of stuff we're talking about, how technology moved rock forward. I'll give you another one. Do you remember the first Back to the Future film where Marty goes into his father's bedroom at night and scares him awake with a Walkman playing some really scary, loud, distorted guitar?
Yes.
Okay. For the first 35 years of the guitar, maybe the first 30 years of the electric guitar, the whole thing was about volume. You wanted nice, clean, pure guitar sounds. But starting in the early 1960s, the whole idea began to change as people began to embrace distortion and fuzz and noise as beautiful ways to make art. And this goes to a guy named Grady Martin, who was working in Nashville at the time. He was a session guitarist, and he was asked to play on a song by Marty Robbins in 1960. Something went wrong with either his amplifier or the preamplifier in the mixing console in the recording studio, and instead of his guitar coming out nice and clean like every other guitar at that time, it was fuzzy and dangerous sounding. This is kind of cool, but how did that happen? So Grady and a bunch of guys got together and they figured out how to summon guitar distortion on demand in regulated amounts. And this became the foundation of the first ever fuzz pedal, which was released in 1962. And then after 1962, as guitarists began to use bigger and larger and more powerful amplifiers mated with this guitar sound, this guitar distortion pedal, that changed everything. So by the middle of the 1960s, 1965, for example, Keith Richards wakes up in the middle of the night and quickly rips off this thing he heard in his head on a cassette recorder beside his bed. We have Keith Richards and Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and a bunch of other people using distortion pedals with overdriven amplifiers to deliberately create noise that 10 years ago was considered to be completely undesirable. And what that did, not only did it move rock forward and give it a new sound and a new feel, but it also increased the generation gap because the adults in the 1950s never made the leap to enjoying guitar noise that their kids did.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's science and there's technology and there's rock and roll. You see how this works?
Yep, and the invention part of that is, hey, we made a mistake or something went wrong. But you know what? What went wrong was cool. Now we have to replicate it. And that's where science took over, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the whole idea behind the exhibit is to show people, especially students, because there's a very big educational component to this, that to show that things like science and technology and engineering and mathematics have very important applications in everyday life, including the music that they listen to. I'll give you another example. One of the things that we have in recording studios and used in live situations right now is a device called AutoTune, which automatically corrects any pitch problems that a singer may have.
Yep.
So everybody can sound perfect using AutoTune. If you turn up AutoTune really, really loud, you get that really, really high, you get that robotic sort of sound. It's the Cher effect, because most people first heard about it in the song Do You Believe in Love?
Mm-hmm.
AutoTune was created by a guy who was working as a geophysicist for an oil company. And the technology in AutoTune was originally used to find oil deposits and gas deposits deep underground. And he discovered through a series of strange misadventures and quirks that the same technology could be used to correct pitch in the sounds of singers' voices. And then later, people discovered that if you turn it up really high, you get this very unique sort of sound. So who would think that somebody exploring for oil and gas would end up changing the sound of popular music.
Talking with Alan Cross, who's the director of content for the Science of Rock exhibit, which is now at Kansas City's Union Station, and hopefully will move across the country later on. While we're talking about things that were, you know, formed in one area and then ended up helping another one, for instance, the example you just gave us, which ended up becoming auto-tune, which, as you said, did change popular music, I heard an example of one that went the other way. That something that the Beatles did, or you can correct me on this story because I really don't have it straight at all.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about.
That the Beatles are responsible for CAT scans.
Yes, they are.
Now, that has to be explained.
Okay, so there was an engineer working at EMI, which was electronic, it was a British company from the 1920s. And EMI was this huge conglomerate, and they did a variety of things, including making phonograph records and phonographs. They had a research and development division, and there was a physicist who had this whole thing that was using magnetic resonance. And they couldn't find an application for it because the development costs were very, very high. But then along come the Beatles in the early 1960s, and they generated so much revenue for the recorded music division of EMI that this resulted in a flood of new research dollars into the R&D part of the company. And this physicist, who had been working on this magnetic resonance technology for all these years, finally got the resources that he needed. And by 1967, he had come up with what would be known later as the CAT scan.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up winning a Nobel Prize for it. And had it not been for the Beatles and the amount of money that they generated for the parent company, who knows what might have happened. So, yes, if you ever have to have an MRI or a CAT scan, you can thank the Beatles.
I love that story. Thanks for clarifying that for me, because I'd heard something about it and I didn't know whether it was true.
Absolutely, 100% true.
So what is pushing the technology envelope in the science of rock today? Here we are at the end of 2012, on the cusp of 2013. What is happening now in music that we're going to see the effects of in the next decade or so?
Well, it's digital, obviously. And I think what we're seeing, digital music is what it is. We have MP3s. We've had MP3s for almost 20 years now. They seem to be the ubiquitous file format that everybody uses. So that's not going to change much. What is going to change is distribution and patterns of consumption. The thing that is changing rock in so many different ways is this idea that you no longer have to possess music to enjoy it. It's all about access. If you can get any song you want, any time you want it, anywhere you happen to be, with whatever device you happen in your hand, why do you ever need to actually buy a record or buy a CD or buy something physical, even if it means downloading a physical track from iTunes onto your computer? You really don't need to. You've got Spotify, you've got RDO, you've got Slacker, and all these other streaming music services that for 10 or 15 bucks a month will give you all the music that you can possibly want without ever actually having to possess it. So there's a very, very big shift in consumer attitudes towards music and consumer consumption patterns when it comes to music. Music now is as close to free as it's ever going to be. And what does that mean for how we value it? How does it mean how we listen to it, how we store it? Think about when you and I grew up, you had to put on a record, and like you said, 20 minutes later, you had to get up, walk across the room, turn the thing over, and start all over again. You couldn't skip songs. You couldn't change the order of songs. Now, all that is taken for granted, and that is also changing the way people look at music, the way people listen to music, the way people value music. So we're seeing these huge shifts, and if you watch your children, you'll see that the way they interact with music is much different from the way you do, and their expectations for what they pay for music, where they get music, and how they listen to it are completely different. I've got a nephew who's 14 years old. He has never set foot in a record store because he doesn't understand the point.
Yeah. And that's why there are so few of them left.
Well, that's it. And so we're seeing, you know, the technology is affecting rock and roll in the way that, you know, record stores are either disappearing or they're having to refocus what they sell in their stores.
Yep.
You're seeing independent record stores change the way they do business. You're seeing bands change the way that they distribute records, or maybe they don't bother distributing records at all. Maybe they just put everything up online on Facebook or something.
Right.
You're seeing record labels change the way they do business. So technology is rewriting the rules when it comes to not only rock and roll, but every source of music.
Yeah, it's also killing off some professions, like one that you and I remember very well, the album cover artist. The guy who did those covers for Yes and the Moody Blues. There's no such equivalent in 2012.
Storm Thurgeson, yeah, you know, he was a fantastic artist, and for decades, album artwork was considered to be a real high calling.
Yeah.
But now,
it doesn't
album
exist.
Artwork, liner notes, who needs it? I'll just go to Wikipedia and find out what I need to know.
All right, now let's get the plug in for the Science of Rock exhibit at Kansas City's Union Station. It's interactive, right? You've got all sorts of things people can actually touch and play with.
Yes, and not only that, you get a backstage pass when you go in with a QR code on the back. And when you do all your stuff, like sing or give some of your memories or learn to play a guitar or play a drum set, what you can do is record and share those performances with your friends using social media. So it's not only stuff that you leave behind, but it's stuff that you take with you. Digitally, of course.
Very cool. The exhibit will be in Kansas City through May. That's your plan?
That's the plan. Then after that, we're hoping Detroit, and I'm waiting to find out whether or not some people in Singapore want to hear about it.
Well, we hope you'll eventually get it to St. Louis as well.
Well, we would like to, absolutely. If it's just it's a short drive, I highly recommend it. We have had zero negative comments about it, and there's really nothing quite like it out there. I mean, you can go see any other, you know, dinosaur exhibit or the science of Star Trek or the science of Harry Potter. This is the first one that we can think of that has ever taken rock and roll seriously in terms of its history and its development from a science and technology point of view.
You can find out more by going to scienceofrock.com. That's the website for the exhibit that's now at Kansas City's Union Station and will be there for the next 5 months or so. Alan Cross, Director of Content for the Science of Rock. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
You're very welcome.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.